Hello, this is Dave with the News Gazette for the weekend of August 1st and 2nd, 2026. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with the headline, Victory Lap. There's a photograph of runners, St. Jude Run, Monticello to Peoria, with the caption, the 32 participants in the St. Jude Monticello to Peoria Run waved to fans while taking a lap around Courthouse Square on Friday evening in downtown Monticello. The event, dedicated to longtime participant Natalie McDowell, who died in an accident in 2021, saw the group set out at 5:15 p.m. from Monticello United Methodist Church, where she was a youth leader. And from the weekend special, it's titled, Fearless, 70 years after Eastern Illinois' first black athlete made history as a Tuskegee Airman, Charleston to honor Major Charles Blakeslee Hall. This is by Carolyn Cloyd. In March of 1941, the 99th Pursuit Squadron, the U.S. Army Air Corps' first all-black fighter unit, was activated at Chanute Field in Rantoul. Ground crews received training at Chanute, while aviation cadets were trained in Tuskegee, Alabama. Among the pilots of the 99th was a young black student at Eastern Illinois State Teachers College in Charleston, Charles Blakeslee Hall, who would go on to become the most well-known Tuskegee Airman of his day. Born on August 25th, 1920, in Brazil, Indiana, to Frank, who worked in a lumberyard, and Anna, a housewife, the family's youngest of two children was described as a modest, unassuming, and unspoiled young man who was a credit to his community. Charlie, as his family called him, attended Brazil High School, where he was a standout on the football and track teams. A high school classmate, Warren D. Williams, would later say that Charles was a shy, quiet young man with the body of Charles Atlas, who gave 110% all the time. In 1936, Harry Sockler, a graduate of Eastern Illinois State Teachers College, was hired as the high school football coach in Brazil. Sockler began encouraging some of the young men at the high school, including Charles, to go to Eastern. Charles' father had great hopes for his son and encouraged him in whatever he wanted to accomplish. But he passed away in December of 1940 after a long illness. A scholarship, such as those offered by the Eastern Illinois Teachers College, was probably a necessity for Charles. He enrolled at what today is known as Eastern Illinois University in the fall of 1938, one of its first black students. His listed major was physical education, but working in the medical field was his ultimate goal. Eastern's student-led news organization, the Eastern Teachers News, later reported that Charles was one of 60 men to report to Coach Harold Avenue for football that September, and that he was working towards the day he would become a doctor. Charles played halfback in football and ran track at Eastern's Schaurer Field. The football section of the Eastern yearbook, The Warbler, referred to the young man who'd become the school's first black athlete as a fast and flashy freshman. He worked at Walt Warmoth's little campus while attending Eastern. The little campus was later known as Ike's Little Campus, or Ike's, and is still open today. Charles reported to work at 4 a.m. every day, where he mopped and washed dishes and shined shoes in a nearby barbershop. While attending school in Charleston, Charles lived in two homes owned by Daniel and Clara Yates. Daniel was a well-known and successful black businessman who owned a Charleston barbershop, most likely where Charles worked. Charles remained friendly with Mr. and Mrs. Yates after he left Eastern. But the trajectory of Charles Hall's life would soon change. In January 1941, the U.S. War Department announced the formation of an all-black Army Air Corps pursuit squadron. On March 22, 1941, the 99th Pursuit Squadron, later known as the 99th Fighter Squadron, was activated at Chanute Field, just 70 miles north of Charleston. A month later, Charles dropped out of school, telling the registrar's office he was going to join the Army. Just 20 years old at the time, he told his mother that Negro boys had just been accepted into aviation, and that if he were drafted, he would have to accept any service assigned to him. He enlisted in the U.S. Army Air Corps as an aviation cadet. He was called up in November and sworn in on November 12, 1941. Charles had never even been on a plane. From Lonely Eagles to Red Tails. Charles Hall was sent to the Tuskegee Army Airfield in Alabama for training. The cadets were given the same flight school coursework as their white counterparts on other bases, but felt the constant pressure of the exacting standards placed upon them by white military leaders who expected them to fail. Cadets had to pass primary, basic, and advanced flying training. Graduates would then proceed to transition training to learn to fly specific aircraft for the war effort. While in training, Charles earned the nickname Sea Buster, or Sea Buster, from the men of the 99th. He graduated with the 4th class out of Tuskegee on July 3, 1942, and was commissioned as a second lieutenant. A combined 12 men graduated in the first 3 classes, and 14 followed in the 4th. Those 26 men, along with their ground support crews, formed the 99th Fighter Squadron. While back home in Indiana, on leave in December 1942, Charles married his sweetheart, Miss Maxine Parrish from Terre Haute. The 99th Fighter Squadron was trained and ready, but languished at Tuskegee for 9 months without deploying into combat. As the first all-black unit, the U.S. Army had trouble finding a fighter group to accept them. Tuskegee's commanding officer, Colonel Noel Parrish, made frequent trips to Washington, D.C., inquiring why a fully trained fighter squadron was sitting at Tuskegee when there was a war going on. Colonel Parrish's efforts finally produced results in April of 1943, when the 99th Fighter Squadron boarded the SS Mariposa and headed to North Africa. They were the very first all-black unit to deploy into combat. Fighter squadrons were normally attached to a fighter group made up of 3 to 4 squadrons. The 99th deployed alone, unattached to any group. We now know these men as the Tuskegee Airmen, but during World War II and the 5 decades that followed, they were known as the 99th Fighter Squadron, or the Negro Squadron. Because they deployed alone, the men of 99th referred to themselves as the Lonely Eagles. The Tuskegee Airmen would also later earn the nickname of the Red Tails for the red painted tails of their P-51s. But the 99th Fighter Squadron, the first of the Tuskegee Airmen, were equipped with the Curtiss P-40 Warhawk, a plane that was considered almost obsolete. Still, Charles appreciated the P-40, saying it was a bit slower than the German planes, but he liked its maneuverability. In February of 1944, H.R. Knickerbocker, a correspondent for the Chicago Sun, wrote that Charles was particularly fond of his plane and had flown it over almost every square foot of ground of North Africa, Sicily, and Italy. Knickerbocker also noted that Charles said the plane had 7 holes from flak and that the tail had been replaced after being shot up. The 99th remained in North Africa for maneuvers and training for a month before they were finally attached to the 33rd Fighter Group with the 12th Air Force in Tunisia. The 33rd's commanding officer, Colonel William Spike Maumier, was very prejudiced and looked for any way he could to discredit the 99th. The men of 99th had yet to receive combat training, something Maumier's squadrons were reluctant to do. It was Colonel Philip Cochran with the 12th Air Force Training Command who stepped in and trained the 99th for combat, focusing on dive bombing and strafing techniques. Cochran, who was white, insisted they get proper training. The men of the 99th, including Charles, later remarked how Cochran welcomed them and never cared about color. Charles later mentioned Cochran as being a great influence. Training black pilots was considered to be an experiment for many in the U.S. military, and men like Maumier seemed determined to see that it failed. The men of the 99th Fighter Squadron felt the pressure, knowing they had to work twice as hard because their success or failure would reflect on their entire race. During World War II, Americans used the phrase V for victory, but the nation's black population felt they were working for a double V. They were willing to fight, even die, for a victory for their country, despite its blatant racism. But they were also working for a victory against that racism. You may be reading about me. In June 1943, the 99th began supporting Operation Corkscrew. The attack on Pantelleria Island's coastal forts and a fortified airfield. On June 2nd, Lieutenant Charles B. Hall and Lieutenant William Campbell were the first men of the 99th to fly into combat as they took to the air over the Italian island. On the morning of July 2nd, Charles and his squadron were escorting medium bombers on a raid on the Castelvetrano airfield in southwestern Sicily. A mixed formation of German fighters approached, some engaging in a short dogfight. Two enemy fighters appeared above the bombers, and Charles turned into the attack to protect them. He shot down one of the planes, a German Focke-Wulf FW-190, becoming the first black combat fighter pilot in American military history to take down an enemy aircraft. After the attack, Charles was separated from the rest of his unit. Enemy fighters dogged him for 20 minutes and then gave up. When his plane touched down, the ground crews erupted in cheers and Charles was given the last chilled bottle of Coca-Cola on the airfield as his reward. General Dwight D. Eisenhower, Allied Commander-in-Chief, and Major General Jimmy Doolittle, Commanding General of the Northwest African Strategic Air Force, were nearby and flew in to personally congratulate the lieutenant. Charles' name and tales of his accomplishment were carried in newspapers across America, and the black press praised him for his heroic feat and blasting away the negative stereotypes. Lieutenant Charles B. Hall of Brazil, Indiana, was now famous. A few days later, Charles had a swastika painted on his P-40 to indicate he had taken down an enemy plane. He also had the words "Cool Papa" painted next to his name, a reference to the moniker given James Bell, a Negro Leagues baseball legend from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. Shortly after, Charles wrote a letter to his mother back home and told her, "You may be reading about me. The flying is fine," he added, "but we are playing for keeps now." Charles' heroics on July 2nd proved to be the 99th Fighter Squadron's sole aerial victory in 1943. He became the leader of sea flight for the 99th and found himself leading some of the white squadrons of the 33rd. He later told a war correspondent that made him very proud. Continuing inside the front page, we have Top of the Morning. Something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rossall. Jeff Yockey and other cyclists staged at Urbana's Meadowbrook Park before heading to the Sydney Dairy Barn on Tuesday. We're happy to report that a wonderful full moon tradition started some 15 years ago is still going full speed. On Tuesday night at Meadowbrook Park in Urbana, 50 cyclists of all ages gathered for a 22-mile ride to Sydney and back. The halfway mark is a highlight. Everyone hops off their bike for treats at Sydney Dairy Barn. "It's just a community show-and-go ride," said Jeff Yockey, a Champaign County Bikes board member and participant in the monthly ride since day one. Numbers are growing again after a post-pandemic lull. Tuesday's crowd included 10 first-timers. "It's 2 hours of pedaling, split up by 1 hour of socializing in Sydney. The moon lights the way along country roads that don't see much traffic. We usually get passed by 5 or 6 cars," Yockey said. Early on, then Sydney barn owner Dennis Riggs would stay open late to accommodate the group. "That hasn't changed, even as ownership did. It's been our destination since we started," Yockey said. The next two rides will take place August 28th and September 25th, and you don't have to be Greg LeMond to tag along. Details are available on the Prairie Cycle Club's Facebook page. And in history, area history, in 1926, when longtime Urbana resident Joe Keller recently died, even his closest friends were unaware of his exploits that had filled newspapers across the country in 1876. That's when Keller, then a deputy U.S. Marshal in St. Joseph, Missouri, led a posse that was chasing the famous Williams Brothers gang after a daring robbery. He came upon three of the bandits, each holding two guns. Keller shot and killed all of them. In 1976, Comptroller George Lindbergh urged Governor Daniel Walker to sign a bill passed by the Illinois General Assembly that would streamline the state treasury by eliminating inactive fund accounts. Lindbergh told reporters at the Champaign County Fair that Walker's signature on the 18-month Fund Sunset Act would enable the comptroller's office to eliminate accounts that were inactive for 18 months and place some of the money in those accounts in the state's general revenue fund. Under the new law, special state accounts would automatically be terminated after 18 months, while accounts of special trust funds created for federal or private money granted to the state could be dissolved at the discretion of the comptroller. In 2011, a year has gone by since more than 150 wall dogs descended on Danville to paint 15 murals depicting everything from local to national historical figures and businesses to people who lived here and went on to make it big in Hollywood. Wall Dogs 2.0 will kick off Wednesday and be a petite version of last year's painting marathon, but have a similar number of associated events during the painting days of Thursday through Saturday. International history, today's highlight. On August 1, 1981, MTV began its American broadcast. The first music video aired on the new cable TV network was "Video Killed the Radio Star" by the Buggies. And continuing with our communities, former Dairy Queens, titled Sweet Spots No Matter the Name, franchisees cut ties with chain in place of costly remodel. This is by Jana Wiersema. In 1954, a shiny new Dairy Queen was built at 349 North Railroad Avenue in Paxton. A little less than 15 years after the 1940 opening of the chain's first location in Joliet, per the company's website. The Paxton location, a small shop that just sells ice cream, drinks, and desserts, really has pretty much stayed the same since the 1950s, said co-owner Ray Umble. Until now, that is. As of today, Umble and his wife's restaurant is now officially Dairy Dream, something locals realized a day or two before the menu changed, thanks to a fresh paint job by local artist Nate Grice. Humble told the News Gazette that Dairy Queen had determined that his location and others did not meet its modern standards and would have to make renovations to reflect the brand's current look. Rather than shell out about $200,000 or more to make the required changes, which Humble said were mostly cosmetic, he decided to cut ties with the company. Across the Ford Iroquois County line, a Dairy Queen in Cisna Park is also rebranding, with plans to become Thomas Grill and Creamery. Co-owner Ashley Verkler said the store faced the same modernization issue as the Paxton location. The Verklers are also stepping away from the business due to their daughter's health and are handing the reins to Brandon and Rhonda Thomas, who will take over August 15th. We have complete confidence that they will continue serving this community with kindness, integrity, and a genuine love for people, the Verkler family wrote in a Facebook post. August 14th will be the location's last day as a Dairy Queen, and former employees are invited to stop by at 6 p.m. August 6th for a reunion. Humble said the newly dubbed Dairy Dream has a menu similar to what his customers are used to, but not identical. Leaving the chain means leaving behind Dairy Queen's proprietary products and getting different ingredients. But he thinks the ice cream mix from his new supplier will be a little bit of a richer flavor. We're actually going to expand the flavors for our mixers and our sundaes and shakes and all that, and our frozen coffee beverages, he said. So we think it's going to be a good thing overall. There have been some rumors on social media that the newly rebranded business might face competition from a new Dairy Queen off Interstate 57. Dairy Queen's corporate communications team provided the following statement from an individual simply identified as a DQ franchise owner with the franchise rights for the Paxton area. The franchise owner of the DQ restaurant at 349 Railroad Avenue in Paxton signed a contract with another existing franchise owner to relinquish their DQ franchise rights in Paxton. This agreement was between the two franchise owners, and American Dairy Queen Corporation was not involved. It is premature to share details about any proposed location in this area at this time. I will not confirm or deny the possibility of a Dairy Queen going into the new gas station convenience store being developed at 580 South Cherry Street, said Paxton Mayor Bill Engel. The Cherry Street site is about a mile away from Dairy Dream. Humble also could not address the rumor. As for the corporate changes Humble mentioned, the American Dairy Queen Corporation told the News Gazette that the company strives to maintain the highest standards at DQ restaurants to meet and exceed fan expectations. We expect that franchise owners will, at a minimum, meet our operational standards in restaurant appearance, food, and treat quality, and fan experience, it said. As with many franchisors, contract renewal often requires improvements or upgrades to existing locations, and the locations in Paxton and Cisna Park remain DQ restaurants at this time. Additionally, there is no strategy to convert all iconic DQ restaurants to our latest design standards. And from Kathy's mailbag, among the many questions asked of our multimedia reporter, Kathy Reiser, I saw that Virginia Theater director Stephen Bentz is retiring this week. He leaves big shoes to fill. Does the Champaign Park District have anyone in mind to fill them? Executive Director Sarah Sandquist said the Park District is grateful for his more than 15 years of service to the Virginia Theater and the district. Stephen has played an important role in shaping the theater's programming and identity, bringing a wide variety of entertainment, and hundreds of thousands of patrons through its doors, she said. We appreciate his dedication, creativity, and many contributions to the Virginia Theater and wish him all the best in retirement. Sanquist said Bence's retirement also provides an opportunity to evaluate how the Virginia Theater fits within our broader organizational structure. As part of that effort, the theater will transition into the Recreation Department, bringing the district's cultural arts facilities and programming under a more unified leadership structure and creating greater opportunities for coordination and collaboration. As part of this new structure, the district is adding a position of Assistant Director of Recreation that is currently posted and applications are being accepted. Sanquist said the district has also entered into a contract with Kevin Maynard, who will provide talent buying and booking services for the Virginia Theater. And I saw the former Gasoline Alley car repair shop being demolished this week, along with a couple of old houses and garages nearby. What's next for that block? If I were a betting person, I'd put my money on more student apartments. Vacant lots take up almost all of that city block now. Those properties seem to be under related ownership, giving developers a chance to think big. Champaign Building Safety Supervisor Randy Smith confirmed that the city has active demolition permits for 57, 59, and 61 East Springfield Avenue, as well as 503 South First Street. The city has no active building permits for any of the seven properties. Champaign County's real estate database shows G7 Living owns the three easternmost properties in that block, and First and Springfield LLC owns the four lots west of them. The mailing address for both companies is 212 East Springfield Avenue, Champaign, the same address as the University Group developers. And yes, the snowmobile is gone. Landmarks aren't always made of bricks and mortar. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the August 1st, 2nd edition for the News Gazette 2026. Please stay tuned.